Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purzell. An 8-member study group recently delivered a report to City Manager Milton Dehoney concerning the Greater Cincinnati Waterworks. Right now, the city owns the system, but the group just spent 14 months studying whether it should be an independent, locally controlled public water district. The report says it should be. Lynn Marmer, who's a vice president with Kroger Company, chaired the study group. WVXU's Jay Hanselman spoke with her about the report.
Lynn, thanks for joining me this morning.
You're welcome.
An independent, locally controlled public water district. Describe for me what that would look like.
It's something that is allowed under state law in Ohio. There are, in fact, a few of them. Most of them are in the northern part of the state, but there is one in Butler County, Ohio. There's also one in Louisville, Kentucky, that is really closest to what a Greater Cincinnati Regional Water Utility might look like. The purpose of it is to have a more flexible business model than we currently have today. Today, the Water Works is a department of the city. It does a great job. We have terrific water rates in terms of their competitiveness with the region, but they are constrained. They're constrained in their ability to grow. There's a state law which limits the number of other areas that a municipal water works can serve. And so they're beginning to get to the outer limits, if you will, of the customer base that they can develop. And, you know, you could say, well, so what? What's the difference?
Well, that was going to be. So,
so
why,
what?
Why does it need to grow?
Well, and the reason why it needs to grow is that is a couple. The first of which is that there's a declining use of water, particularly within the city and the close-in suburbs. Think of all the manufacturing that's no longer here. And in fact, over a 20-year period, water use by commercial users within the region and area has declined almost 50%. Companies like Lunkenheimer and Hudepohl Brewery and Bauer Dairy, those are all not here anymore. So you have a decline in consumption. That means you have a decline in customers. And when you begin to look at what's down the road, you have two factors that are concerning. The first is the aging infrastructure in the city and, again, close-in suburbs. That's where the oldest part of the waterworks is today, and it's an area that will need to have a pretty substantial capital investment over a short period of time in order to keep maintaining it and to repair it. In addition, you have EPA regulations that keep getting higher and higher. That's a good thing. We want safe and clean water. But those new technologies are very expensive. So when you have a declining customer base and you can identify very clearly increases in costs that are ahead, it becomes concerning. And if you grow the water district, then you continue to have the kind of economies of scale which we enjoy today.
So part of this is if the customers are shrinking, costs are increasing, if you don't do something, each one of those customers is eventually going to have to pay substantially more for their water.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the Waterworks needs to find new customers. The current setup state law just won't allow that to happen.
We're at just about at the end of what they can do, and they have done a remarkable job. They're very entrepreneurial. They serve 50 other jurisdictions besides the city of Cincinnati, including jurisdictions in northern Kentucky. There's a water pipe which runs under the Ohio River, which is pretty amazing. But they're reaching a limit of what they can do.
Who would control this water district, and who would determine its leadership?
This is a kind of a unique structure. I don't know that we have very many things like this in our community. It would be an independent, freestanding, public entity. It would not be a private entity. It wouldn't be a for-profit or even a nonprofit. It would be a public entity. It's regulated by state law, and it would have a board, and that board would be appointed. Our recommendation as a citizens group is that there be 9 members on the board, 7 of whom would be appointed by city council, and 2 would be regional appointees. So for the first time, jurisdictions outside of the Cincinnati area or city of Cincinnati would be able to participate in the governance of the waterworks, which we think is really a good thing and a very appealing thing to suburban customers.
Could this in any way look like the board that manages the Metro bus system, the SORTA board?
It's different.
We're talking water and transportation, but SORTA is managed by a board that now has more regional representatives.
That's a good model to look at and say, yes, there's some similarities.
What's in this for the city of Cincinnati?
A couple things. The first of which is that today, City of Cincinnati residents enjoy a substantial discount on their water. There are water rates, if you live in the city or are a business in the city, are 25% less than those in the suburbs. So that discount, if you will, or rate difference would continue. The second thing is that the city would be paid for the asset. It is an asset that is owned by the City of Cincinnati. And this water district would pay for the asset. The asset's been valued at about $400 million. So the city would receive payments over 75 years. They would begin around $6 million, and they would grow to an average of $14 to $18 million a year. So they'd receive a substantial income stream.
There are some groups that are already opposed to this. Matter of fact, they were announcing their opposition even before you released your report. And that's one of the things they talk about, that the water district would basically have to buy the waterworks in the system from the City of Cincinnati. But their argument is the taxpayers, the ratepayers, paid for all of this stuff. So why should they have to pay to buy it back?
And that is certainly something that the citizens group talked about extensively. In the end, the City of Cincinnati owns the utility. It can choose to keep it as a city department, or it can choose to transfer it to the water district. But it is an asset that they own. And I think the analogy that probably fits the best is it's a little like a hotel. If you own a hotel and I come and I stay a night, I pay you for that night. And so what the taxpayers in the city have received is they've received water service. It's been an equal exchange up until this point. I've paid for the water I've used, but that doesn't entitle me to ownership. Ownership resides, in this case, with the City of Cincinnati, and it's a valuable asset that they own, and we think compensation for them is reasonable and fair.
Why bring this forward now during a year when every city council member is running for re-election, and doesn't that complicate the issue and make it harder for it to happen?
You know, I think that's an interesting question. I really believe that our council members, both the present members of council and also those who are running for office, are truly interested in, you know, what's for the good of the citizens. And as, you know, you pointed out early on in our conversation, if we don't do something, we will face increasing rates. And as a result, we think planning for the future is a good idea. The city manager asked us to study this, and he asked us to be objective. The reality is we were pretty skeptical about it, but in the end, our study group came to the conclusion that this is really in the best interest of both the city and the region. And we believe that, you know, a good public discussion of that will help air it out, and people can make their own choice.
Lynn Marmer is a vice president with the Kroger Company, and she chaired the Cincinnati City Manager's Water District Working Group. Manager Milton Dehoney is reviewing the report and plans to make his recommendation to council on the proposal in about a week. Lynn, thanks for being here this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Jay Hanselman.
For this week's Field Notes, Thane Maynard is joined by Jennifer Browning, Executive Director of the Biodiversity Project.
Well, Jennifer, I'll tell you what I was excited about was not just the Biodiversity Project, which I've known a bit about over time, but I know this new initiative called the Great Lakes Town Hall, which I think is new, is pretty neat. I think you all are getting a lot of input.
Yes. We've been very excited about our Great Lakes Town Hall. It has it actually has been in existence for about 3 years now, but it started out quite small, very much a sort of a grassroots approach to collecting people who, collecting ideas and thoughts of people who were in the Great Lakes region. And it has really blossomed into this wonderful online community of Great Lakes residents from all 8 Great Lakes states and 2 Canadian provinces. And people have an opportunity to share their thoughts and ideas about any Great Lakes related issue.
Well, you know what was interesting? When I initially looked at it, it had folks from quite a disparate background and geographically as well, as you said, all the way from Toronto to Detroit, Chicago. But then you'd start to see other towns that weren't, as we might think of as Great Lake towns, but, you know, a Madison, Wisconsin, which is not right on the lake. And, of course, our listeners to this show are down here in the Ohio River Valley. But again, here in Ohio and listeners in Indiana, those are Great Lakes states. So is there a connection there as well?
Absolutely. The Great Lakes Town Hall really is for people not just within the Great Lakes Basin, but it's really for people who care about the Great Lakes. And so certainly that includes residents from Great Lakes states.
Absolutely. And I know, for instance, I, like many people in our region down here, head up that way at least once a year. Typically for me, it's around bird migration. Great places like Point Pelee coming out of Ontario or McGee Marsh down in northern Ohio. And those ecosystems are tied directly to the Great Lakes. But tell us a bit about the Biodiversity Project.
Biodiversity Project has actually been around for about 13 years, and we were in Madison for most of those years, but have recently relocated in Chicago. We actually wanted to be a little closer to the Great Lakes. It is an area that we focus on, and so that was one of the reasons that actually we moved to the Chicago area. And Biodiversity Project works in a couple different ways, but primarily our focus is on communications and education, and helping people understand environmental issues and connecting that knowledge with closely held values. And to do our work, we do a lot of research, actually, and we do a lot of public opinion research. Our goal is to figure out what people know and how they think and feel about a resource that we're working on protecting. And then we use that information to help reach out to folks in the area.
Tell me this. How are things going with your program? You said 13 years, so it sounds like you're thriving.
It is. We're doing quite well. We are kind of a behind-the-scenes organization a little bit. Like for our Great Lakes work, we've built the Great Lakes Town Hall, and we help move the program forward. But really, it's a program that exists because people are interested in it and because the public and the Great Lakers, as we like to call them, mm-hmm. are involved and concerned about the issue. So Biodiversity Project has been sort of played that role for a while. We're now moving a little bit more into some more active public education and outreach. We are beginning to launch our water conservation campaign in the Great Lakes states. We're looking to begin to raise people's awareness about water conservation. It's really hard when you look at the Great Lakes and it looks so plentiful to believe that there is potentially, you know, a concern about water quantity. But indeed there is, and we need to... As people who live in this area, we sort of have been given the responsibility of stewarding this area as well. And so protecting our water resources is something that we feel is important and something that people can get really actively involved with.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I think one of the things that people often believe is, sure, out in Phoenix or Tucson or maybe California, there can be water shortages because they're fairly arid regions. But as you said, even here in the lush Midwest, water levels can be down, and water is a finite resource. How is that affecting the Great Lakes?
In terms of reduced lake levels, are definitely it's hard to talk about this because we've had such a wet year and a wet winter, but lake levels overall are down, and we anticipate with the global climate change that our lake levels will continue to drop, and that does a couple things. One thing it does is even though our lakes are getting cleaner, lower lake levels reduces the amount of water, and so it really concentrates pollutants, making it harder to clean our drinking water. And another thing it does is it's harder for our natural wetland system and the other sort of natural functions of the lake to occur when our lake levels are down. And so, you know, making sure that our lakes continue to be plentiful and healthy is something that is very important.
Absolutely. I've been lucky to visit most of the Great Lakes and, in fact, gone swimming in most. And as you said, they are cleaner than someone might imagine when you think of them as having some of the biggest industrialized ports in, North America, and yet really still, in many areas, very much thriving. What are the biggest threats right now to America's Great Lakes?
I would say that water quantity, we believe, is a big threat. It's going to be a long-term concern that we really need to make people aware of. But some of the other very serious threats that are facing our lakes right now have to do with invasive species. It's mm-hmm. certainly a very big issue. Pollution is another big issue. And in fact, one of the greatest sources, though, of pollution in our lakes actually comes from the air. It doesn't really come from huge industries dumping their waste into the lake. And not to say that that's okay or we don't want to reduce that, but it's actually not one of the biggest sources. But it really does come from our coal-burning power plants and air pollution. Hmm. So those are some of the really big things that are impacting our lakes and that we need to be careful of. Another quite big issue is that most of the cities around the Great Lakes are older and have aging sewer systems, and those systems are just not capable of managing heavy stormwater runoff. So when it rains real hard, our systems are overtaxed, and so a lot of sewage can fall into the lake and gets put into the lake. And so that's a big concern as well. Certainly Detroit's having very big problems with that, as well as Milwaukee, are just examples. I'm not pointing fingers.
No, but, I fully understand. We have some of those challenges in Cincinnati, which is an older town as well with an older infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jennifer, if there is one thing that listeners could do, not just to help the Great Lakes, but to help the biodiversity and the area where they live, what's the one thing you'd recommend folks do?
I have a real firm belief that we are going to be facing some water problems. And I think if everybody could just become more aware about the amount of water that they use and how they use it, and unfortunately how much water we waste every day, because that's just been something that we've become accustomed to, I think that would be a very important first step, is for people to realize how much water they use and think about some of the simple things they could do to reduce their water consumption.
Because I know you are right. The amount we use, if you really measure it, is quite surprising. I know at the Cincinnati Zoo, we were blown away when about 3 years ago we started to do an earnest water use audit. I mean, at a zoo, I'm talking about millions of gallons. But by taking a hard look at it, we were able to save quite a bit. So on an individual basis, it's important as well.
Absolutely. The average family of four uses about 400 gallons of water per day.
Mm.
And it's actually really pretty easy to cut that down by about 30% just with changing some fixtures in your kitchen and in your bathroom and changing some habits a little bit. So it's actually not too hard to do, to just reduce it by 30%, which is quite significant.
Well, that's great. Well, listen, thank you for sharing some of your work with us.
Absolutely, Dane. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Jennifer Browning. She's the executive director of the Biodiversity Project. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purzell. Still to come, tips from the author of Cooking Green, Reducing Your Carbon Footprint, The New Green Basics Way. But next, internationally renowned best-selling author and founder of The Work, Byron Katie. Katie will be in Cincinnati next weekend for a lecture, book signing, and workshop at the New Thought Unity Center, and is joining me on the phone from California. Hello and welcome, Katie.
Hi, Mark.
For those unfamiliar with The Work, please share the story of how you came to find The Work in your life.
Well, you know, it was after years of depression, more than a decade of depression and awful paranoia and, you know, extreme low self-esteem. In fact, I was so full of self-hatred that I actually slept on the floor beside my bed. And that's a very confused woman. And one morning, Mark, as I lay sleeping on the floor, actually a cockroach crawled over my foot. And I opened my eyes, and for no reason at all, there was a world that I had not ever, ever imagined. You know, I thought the only way out of a life of suffering was death. But I opened my eyes, and in place of all that darkness was a most wonderful world, you know, and that's where I get the title, Loving What Is. And it was such an amazing experience. It stayed with me for 23 years. That was 23 years ago. And the important thing that came out of that experience is true for all of us, I've come to see. It's when I believe my thoughts, I suffer. And when I don't believe them, I don't suffer. So I've come to see that this is true for every human being. So that's what I do, what I do.
So what is The Work, as you
call
it?
The Work, and I didn't know what else to call it. It was my work, and I couldn't claim it because it came freely. And so, you know, it belongs to anyone whose mind is open to it. And The Work is a way to identify and then question the stressful thoughts that cause all the suffering and violence in the world. It literally is the end of war inside our heads. And when we're no longer at war with ourselves, then we stop being at war with the people in our lives, you know, in our homes, in our communities, and literally the entire world. And, you know, the world, I've come to see, is there's not a problem in the world. Everything is happening on time. It is what it is perfectly. It's what we're believing about the world that needs a little work. So this is a way to identify those thoughts and then question them. And what I love about The Work is, you know, why not? For some of us, it just couldn't be worse. So why not question what we're believing about the world, rather than just believe it? For one thing, Mark, you know, we believe our thoughts. We have to live our lives out of those thoughts. We have to live our lives out of what we believe. We have to believe before we can even see something. You know, we can't see what we don't believe first. So truly, the world is a projection of mind.
Well, after reading Loving What Is, it just seems so simple. Why don't folks spend more time questioning their own thoughts?
Well, you know, we haven't known how. No one has shown us how. We have read the great masters and we have heard the great masters speak, you know, like there are one or two in our lifetime maybe, but they don't tell us how. So the work is how. It's how. There's freedom. We know that that's our birthright. Well, the work is how.
It seems that your epiphany 23 years ago was nearly instantaneous. It was in the moment. But this approach in The Work, this approach to self-realization is really ongoing, not just that momentary act, correct?
It's ongoing. It's ongoing. You know, the mind is an unlimited source. And when it's no longer stuck in those thoughts, you know, believing thoughts that we haven't even questioned, once we get that taken care of, the mind is purely creative, and life is there for us like a banquet, and all we have to do is fearlessly open our arms to it, and it's, you know, unlimited world, unlimited life.
In your work with The Work, it really covers many different types of stressful thoughts or thoughts
that cause
stress, but is there one point or one stressful thought that you find to be really prevalent in all the people that you meet?
There are so many of them. I've come to see, Mark, that there are no new stressful thoughts, that they're all recycled. Like there's no one that hasn't had the thought, no one cares about me, or they were unkind to me, or I can't do it, or there's something wrong with me, or I shouldn't have done it. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There's something odd about me. No one cares. I need more money. I'm too fat. I'm not tall enough. You know, oh my goodness, those are concepts that we have all experienced, and we each of us individually take credit for them as though they're personal. But, you know, if someone thinks the thought, no one really cares, you know, it's like, oh, that's not their thought, that's my thought. You know, if we tried to take possession of it, but they're universal. I travel all over the world. I've been traveling for years by invitation. And in every language in the world, it doesn't matter what language, there are no new stressful thoughts. So just imagine those universal stressful thoughts, some of them that I just, you know, gave examples of. Imagine if we didn't believe them. Imagine if only our positive thoughts existed. They make sense. People care about me. You know, there are maybe listeners right now that say, well, that's not true. Everyone cares about someone. Or, you know, that's not really true for everyone. Whatever we think about it, in my world, because I've questioned my mind, I walk into a room, there can be several thousand people there, and I know everyone cares about me. I just don't expect them to realize it yet. And if, you know, they haven't questioned their negative thoughts about me or other human beings. And if they questioned it, and in other words, if they did the work with it, it leaves us in a whole new state of mind and state of being. I'm just home from New York City. I did a Friday night there and then an all-day workshop. And the man that emailed me was only able to, he was a writer and a very successful writer, as it turns out. And he was there only that evening, that Friday evening. And he emailed me, and he said, you know, I don't know what happened. I have no idea what happened, but everything, my whole world is different. Everything looks different. It has shifted, and so dramatically that even my friends are commenting. What happened was he was just ready for a shift, a paradigm shift, literally. And that's what happens when people hear what they've always really known to be true, and they hear it spoken, or they realize it within themselves one way or the other. And so that's what the work is about. It's about questioning our stressful thoughts, the thoughts that cause all the suffering and violence in the world. And every time we do it, no matter what concept we work, these negative concepts, we come out as less frightened, freer, kinder human beings. And I love that, Mark, and I love it so simple that anyone with an open mind can do this, and also that it's free on my website. I have you know, the books for sale at all the local bookstores, et cetera, and on the Internet. But on my website, it's free. It's all there. You know, if it's valuable, it belongs to all of us.
You know, it goes without saying that the current economic climate has caused an increase in stressful thoughts for almost everybody. Uh-huh. Have you seen any changes in the folks you work with recently?
Oh, radical changes. And the people, you know, that are new to the work, coming in to experience it, I just appreciate that so much, you know, that because victims are violent people, I've come to see. And as, you know, a reform victim myself, they come in, you know, stressed out and worried and losing their homes, their jobs, their incomes, and money that they were going to send their children to college with, and money that was going to pay for their health insurance, and they're finding freedom beyond what they wanted money to give them. If our pocketbooks were required for freedom, then there's something wrong with the way, you know, life is all put together. And when we're believing it, there's something wrong in our thinking, not the world.
Byron Katie, best-selling author of Loving What Is, Four Questions That Can Change Your Life, and founder of The Work. Katie will be in Cincinnati next weekend for events at the New Thought Unity Center in Clifton Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You'll find information about her Cincinnati visit and a link to her website at wvxu.org. Thanks, Katie. I appreciate your work.
Mark, you are so welcome. Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. On the way in about 15 minutes and focus on technology, helping horses run faster. With the Kentucky Derby just a couple of weeks away, Ann Thompson takes a look at a company using nutrition and gene expression to produce faster horses. Earth Day is coming up Wednesday. A new book will be released on Earth Day that has tips and recipes to help you shrink your cook print. On the phone from Austin, Texas, author Kate Hayhoe tells Marianne Zalesnik about the new book, Cooking Green, Reducing Your Carbon Footprint in the Kitchen the New Green Basics Way.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I don't know that people really think about it when they turn on the oven or turn on the stove, but as you show in your book, there are all sorts of ways people can really save energy, save fuel in the kitchen. Why don't you talk a little bit about how much you think people can really do just on a day-to-day basis to make a difference?
They can rethink just how they've been cooking for so many years. One of the big things that I point out in the book is that, you know, we've always taken fuel and water for granted. Well, now we kind of have to think about that a little bit more special. And one of the things I point out in the book is that the oven is one of the biggest fuel guzzlers. I call it the Humvee of the kitchen because in a gas oven, for instance, 96% of the fuel that goes into the gas oven is wasted. I'm sorry, 94%. Only about 6% of the fuel actually gets into cooking the food.
Where's the rest go?
It goes into your oven walls. It goes into your kitchen, which generally causes you to turn up the air conditioner in summer months. So you're consequently wasting more fuel. And my recommendation is if you don't have to use the oven, because there's a lot of options that we have for cooking foods, cook it on the cooktop. Use a toaster oven. If you have a convection oven and you're going to put something in the oven, it's about time to learn how to use the convection mode. And I say that, you know, kind of jokingly, because for years I had a convection oven and I was intimidated about turning on the convection mode. Well, convection mode will save about 25% of your fuel.
Let's talk about the convection mode. You talk about it in the book, and it's really just a little bit of a time adjustment or a temperature adjustment to some extent. What are some of the basics if people want to cook in a convection oven?
Let me just talk about what a convection oven is. A true convection oven has a fan that blows in heat and circulates that heat so that it's not just stagnant and collecting in certain areas. So you don't have hot spots and cold spots in your oven. It moves the heat around so it cooks the food more evenly and that consequently makes more efficient use of the fuel. So when you're baking cookies or baked goods, for instance, you're getting that fuel beautifully wrapped around all parts of the food that you're cooking. Baked goods turn out wonderful. Roasts turn out wonderful. What you can do is generally either knock the heat temperature down 25 degrees or cut back about 15 to 20 minutes. And it depends on, and I explain all of this in the book, the rules of thumb there. But you're going to save fuel either by cooking at a lower temperature or by cooking less time.
You mentioned a toaster oven. One of the things you point out in the book is you don't want to get just your average run-of-the-mill toaster oven. Describe the best kind of toaster oven to use that is practical, will save energy, but can do a lot of things.
Yeah, you know, you want to look at some of your better-made, higher-end toaster ovens, just like you would with a regular oven. You want to look at, you know, how well insulated they are. You want to look at size because there's some great toaster ovens now that are coming out, they kind of have a contoured shape to them so they're big enough to accommodate a pizza. And I know, you know, frozen pizzas aren't necessarily the most eco-friendly in terms of the amount of energy that's used, but quite frankly, people live on frozen pizzas. And so one of the points in my book is that I want to make sure that we're talking about how people live today and cutting back at least some portion of the fuel or energy that they use. But going back to toaster ovens, you want to make sure that you've got a size that's going to be practical. Look at some of the consumer reports and consumer reviews about what ovens work best, because there's new ones that come out every day, practically. Sometimes some of them have convection modes that we were just talking about. If it has a convection mode, that's another good thing.
You talk about refrigerators in the book a lot, too, and you say that 11% of the home's electricity goes right through the refrigerator. What are some things you can do to make your refrigerator more efficient, besides buying an energy-efficient refrigerator?
Some of the things that you want to do is you want to make sure that you're running your freezer and your refrigerator at the proper temperatures. You don't want them too high or too cold, rather. You're just going to waste energy. And you don't want them too warm because then, you know, you're going to risk spoilage. And when you have foods frozen and storing at the proper temperatures, they're going to last longer. You're going to have less waste of your perishables there.
Well, that's one thing you talk about also is how you can take care of the fresh produce and the fresh foods that you buy to make them last longer once you get them home. What are some of the things you can do?
It kind of goes back to like the oven having hot spots and cold spots. Refrigerators do that too. If you've got a side-by-side, your coldest area is going to be logically next to the freezer side and in the back of the refrigerator. So things like dairy products, store them in the coldest part of the refrigerator, and meats too. Meats do really well at right around 31 degrees, and you can get to that point by taking, you know, those blue freezer packs or that you buy for picnics and, you know, coolers and things like that. Stick those in your refrigerator. Stick them in the meat bin, and you'll automatically drop that temperature in your meat bin down a few degrees just by having those in there. Another thing is put your milk carton on top of it. It'll keep your milk colder.
When you talk about the kitchen and the cooking green, one of the things that I found interesting is you have a little quiz, and one of the questions is, if your garbage disposal breaks, should you get a new one that's very efficient, get the current one you have fixed, or just take it out? And the answer, surprisingly, is take it out. What's wrong with a garbage disposal?
What happens is, when you chew up your food in the garbage disposal, you turn it on, you're consuming electricity and you're consuming water, which is a very precious resource these days. The chewed up food then goes down through your pipes to a wastewater center. It's filtered out into sludge, gets put on a truck, and then goes to the landfill. There's a whole lot of extra steps in there that you're using and a lot of extra resources you're using versus just taking the food and either putting it into a compost or scraping it into the trash and putting it out with your garbage. Some municipalities are using special collection bins that have lids on them for compostable foods. And like I said, even if you don't compost, just putting it out into the trash is going to save fuel and it's going to save energy.
You have a section where you talk about the different types of foods you can buy and what's better in terms of food packaging, because clearly there are some packaging that causes a lot more waste than others. You say canned vegetables are better than frozen. And it seems to me the frozen bag you could just get rid of really quickly, and the can not so easily. Why do you prefer canned?
Well, it kind of goes back to the whole concept of shrinking your cookprint. And your cookprint looks at the entire chain of resources used to make the food, to grow the food, and to get the food to you. So when you're talking about frozen foods, they're being frozen, then they're being put on a refrigerated truck, and refrigeration and freezing units generate a lot of emissions. So you're getting them on this freezing vehicle, and they're getting to your grocery store where they have to be stored in a frozen container. And then you're getting them home, and they're, you know, using up more freezing capacity there. So you're talking about the fuel to transport them, plus you're talking about the energy used to keep them cold and frozen. Cans, on the other hand, you know, you can recycle them, and they're also shelf-stable. They can help save a trip to the grocery store. And since we're talking about materials, glass is actually the best of all because glass is much more easily recyclable. And the other type of product that I really like is aseptic containers. You know those kind of paperboard, cardboard type of containers that your chicken broth and tomatoes come in these days?
Mm-hmm.
Those are great. They're extremely efficient in terms of the amount of materials that they use. And what a lot of people don't realize is they don't contain BPA or bisphenol A, which is a chemical that can leach from packaging into foods and liquids. Some canned products don't contain BPA, but most of them are lined with BPA.
I want to go back to the frozen versus canned for 1 minute. Mm-hmm. So many health books say eat the frozen over the canned because the nutrient value is better. How do you begin to weigh the difference there?
Actually, a lot of the more recent research is saying that, you know, because the canned products generally go from field almost directly into the can, that you are not facing that same issue of losing a lot of nutrients. They're proving to be just as comparable in nutrient value.
Kate, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate it. And happy Earth Day to everyone. I hope everyone learns how to shrink their footprint, and they can do it painlessly.
Kate Hayhoe is the author of Cooking Green, Reducing Your Carbon Footprint in the Kitchen, The New Green Basics Way. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Marianne Zalesnik.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. Some people run away to join the circus. Matt Madison quit his day job to make gelato, Italian-style ice cream. It's called Madisano's Gelato, and it's billed as Cincinnati's first gelato company. It's also Cincinnati's only gelato company. Madisano celebrates its third anniversary tomorrow. Matt Madison is here today to tell Naomi Lewin how it all began.
Matt Madison, welcome to Cincinnati Edition. Now, first of all, explain the difference between gelato and ice cream.
Gelato and ice cream, there's two primary differences. One, gelato is lower in butterfat than ice cream. And secondly, gelato has less air whipped into it than ice cream. So low butterfat and not as much air whipped into it.
So you're getting more stuff.
Exactly. You get a creamy sensation when it's a lot more dense and less butterfat. And typically, the Italians make gelato with about a 7 to 8% butterfat. And that's what we make ours with, 8%.
So what possessed you to start a gelato business?
Passion for food, creativity. It was just something that I've always wanted to be involved in. Growing up here in Cincinnati, we have a great tradition of ice cream excellence, and we didn't have anyone doing gelato or artisan sorbets, and I saw an opportunity and went for it.
How did you discover gelato?
Being in the specialty food business, I was aware of it. Doing some traveling, although not be it in Italy, but other parts of the country, it's very popular, and I thought this would be something that would really have an opportunity and fit in well to the Cincinnati's palate.
Now, you mentioned the specialty food business. Your family is Madison's Ridgeview Farm with the stand at Findlay Market.
Correct. And that's really where the passion started, from hunting morel mushrooms in Adams County to servicing some of the finest chefs in Cincinnati. And this gives me an opportunity to really be involved in all kinds of cultures here in Cincinnati with respect to foods.
Now, you said you didn't spend time in Italy. I was going to ask whether, since Italy was the home of gelato, you felt obligated to go and do some arduous research.
You know,
there.
I haven't made the pilgrimage yet. Maybe when the kids get a little bit older. I did travel to New York and worked with a mentor there, which is connected to a family from Bologna. And that's where I learned a lot of the initial instruction of the craft and the art. And I was able to bring that back. So I got close, but not yet. Working on it.
So what kind of special equipment do you need to produce gelato?
Well, one, for our purposes, we did import a machine, a batch freezer from Italy, and that's what really gives the signature design and texture to the finished gelato. It can't be any particular machine. We also import several ingredients directly from Bologna, Italy, and that's what's helped us also capture some of the authentic flavors that are there. Other than that, it's typically just good kitchenwares and things like that we use.
I was going to ask about flavors. What do you import from Italy?
Well, we bring in a imported hazelnut paste from Bologna. That's what makes our nocciola so special, and I think that's what people really recognize. Other ingredients that go into that as well. But we do use fine Belgian chocolate. And since I've been producing gelato, I've really ventured out on my own to kind of create my own flavors. Our spice chai, for example, is my own blend of cardamom, cinnamon, clove spice, our lemon basil sorbet, various things like that. So I don't need to go across the pond, so to speak, to get that. It's really more from inspiration.
So you also do make sorbet for those who are lactose intolerant or just...
Correct. I love the idea of sorbets. Not all fruits and things work within a milk-based structure. So a sorbet is totally dairy-free, hence it's fat-free as well, which is nice. And it does meet the needs for people who have dietary restrictions. But sorbet is a completely different platform. It gives me an opportunity to work other aspects and components of food design that gelato doesn't. And it's used differently in the courses of meals. It can be an intermezzo. It can be used, a lot of people are using it, mixing it with drinks and things like that, where you would never put a scoop of gelato in a martini. Pink grapefruit martinis are doing really well these days.
I was going to ask about how you go about creating new flavors, whether you make them all up or whether you take requests.
Well, we do. We take a lot of requests, and we work very closely with a lot of restaurants here in Cincinnati. So we get a lot of requests from chefs. Hey, this is the flavor we want to do. And so we can put that together. But just even reading a lot of magazines, it's amazing. You'll see something and something will pop up and like, wow, that could be a new sorbet flavor. My motto right now is so many flavors, so little time, because it's not possible to do them all. It just isn't. So that's what I go to work for every day, to come up with something new.
Congratulations on 3 years of Madisono's Gelato.
Great. Thank you so much.
Matt Madison is the creative force behind Madisono's Gelato, Cincinnati's first and only gelato company, celebrating its third anniversary. You can find a list of all the places that carry Madisono's Gelato on our website, wvxu.org. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Naomi Lewin.
Next month in Louisville, a field of 20 horses, including favorites Pioneer of the Nile and I Want Revenge, will run for the roses. In the future, one company with research facilities in the Commonwealth may be able to make horses, other animals, and people run faster. It involves nutrition and gene expression. Ann Thompson reports in Focus on Technology.
When Alltech, a global animal health company, opened the Center for Animal Nutrigenomics in Nicholasville last year, president and founder Dr. Pierce Lyons referenced the Kentucky Derby, saying he wanted to someday be able to predict the winner. Figuring out which nutrients turn a gene on and off in this one-of-a-kind facility may not be that far in the future. Dr. Lyons joins us by phone to talk about the technology. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, and of course, you've really put me on the spot. I now have to try and predict the Derby winner. And of course, as I once said, that even if I had the prediction for the Derby winner, and I might want to keep it to myself. But what I was referring to was the gene chip and the amazing technology now that gives us the ability to put a full genome onto a small chip. This chip is no bigger than a calling card. And what it does fundamentally is shows us that when we eat something, when we do something, what genes are turned on and what genes are turned off, or at least turned down. And the analogy I often give is like a light with a dimmer switch on it. We turn the dimmer down, we turn the dimmer up. And that's what we're doing with the genes. And so the sheer impact, first of all, on our animals' health, and then indirectly, of course, on our health, because anymore, we used to say that, you know, you are what you eat. Well, you're not. You are what your animals ate. So if we have animals which are fed in a nutritious way, and they have the important elements such as selenium and calcium and a whole host of other key ingredients present in that meat, they in turn will turn on or off the genes. And so what I was referring to was that if a horse, for example, we wish to have stamina for a longer race, or we want to have speed, then in fact there are different genes that we would wish to turn on or off. I want to emphasize, though, that we're not talking about genetically modifying anything. We're simply understanding and realizing what a critical role nutrition plays in our everyday life. And let me give you an example, or a few examples. We now know from the work that we're doing with animals that there are certain genes which have incredible implications for osteoporosis, incredible implications for Alzheimer's, indeed incredible implications for cancer. Now, knowing that these genes are there and that these genes have to be looked after properly, Is it too far, too much of a stretch to say that I can look at the genes and see that I'm predisposed to getting cancer, I'm predisposed to getting osteoporosis, I'm predisposed to getting Alzheimer's? The answer is no, it is not too much of a jump. And knowing that, that you are predisposed, there's certain foods perhaps you need to avoid, and the gene chip will tell you, proof positive, that in fact, taking those steps, you are reducing those nasty genes, as it were, and you're elevating, even more important, the protective genes within our body. And that's what nutrigenomics is all about, nutrition and the gene.
So how does all this play out? You have the gene chip, so what's the timetable in all this?
The timetable, it's right now. I mean, I have at our Nutrigenomic Center, which is the first ever nutrigenomic center in the world, which is focused on animals. And from those animals, of course, we can make the jump to humans. And right now I have maybe 20 or 30 people working on this.
How does this translate to then whatever animal we want to know about or us? Would we send in a blood sample, or what ultimately, or what kind of information would you pass on?
The key is this. You need to know what genes you should be looking at. And that's where the biochemist comes into play. He says, well, you know, if it's Alzheimer's, perhaps we need to be looking at genes related to oxidative stress, which is, you know, the damage done when we have high rates of metabolism in either in our brain or in our tissue. And so we focus in on those genes. And then having focused in on those genes, then we can predict what will change them, what will impact them. But you're doing so from the background of a whole array of information that you've already accumulated. You see something you want to change. You look back at your scientific library, as it were, and you say, okay, we think this is what we should use. They're all totally non-invasive. They're all related to nutrition. And we're basically improving the protective mechanisms within our bodies. Nutrigenomics is going to revolutionize science. And the really exciting thing, I think, for the Commonwealth of Kentucky and for Northern Kentucky and so forth is that it's happening right now, and it's happening right now in Nicholasville, Kentucky.
Well, thank you so much, President and founder of Alltech, Dr. Pierce Lyons. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Ann Thompson.
This evening on WVXU's Around Cincinnati, TV sports analyst Ron Darling talks about his new book, The Complete Game, which looks at baseball and pitching from the mental as well as physical side. The celebration of National Poetry Month continues with esteemed Southern poet Kathy Smith Bowers reading some of her works. And Ballet Tech Cincinnati Executive Director Marvel Gentry Davis provides details about the world premiere of Myth, the Leaping for Literacy production exploring cultural myths, all on Around Cincinnati this evening at 7. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Bruce Ellis, with assistance from Andy Ellis, Chelsea Vandedrink, and Kevin Rowinski. I'm the executive producer and host, Mark Purcell. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. It's 8 o'clock.